This evening, we would like to perform a song for you titled Why, and it's composed by Swami Kriyananda. There lived a tender maid in a far-off country. The strangeness of this world made her cry. Her friends asked their fathers for money and clothes, but all she could ask was, the bright rays of their joy filled the sky. Her teachers explained it all wisely away, but still her heart wondered why. She saw the silent stars thrill the night with their gladness. They seemed some wondrous truth to imply. Her elders all slept, but the magic of light would wake her to ponder. Smile as she tended her baby, a widow weep that love had to die. The joy of new friends and the sadness of parting, all these made her ask God, one night into her heart stole the secret of oneness, the bond not even time can untie. For love there possessed her and made her his own. In love she at last learned why.
Beautiful, thank you. Thank you. C'è qualche sbaglio nella chitarra. Devo spiegarti.
Va bene.
Ok. Thank you. This is the basic question of my life. Why? That was the third song I ever wrote. And I remember my father on the ski slopes in Predeal, Romania. And he was coming down the slope and I said, Daddy, Daddy, Daddy. He tried to stop, fell down, pulled the snow out of his eyes, said, what, son? Why are the church bells ringing? And this was part of my questioning. Another time, we were in a restaurant in New York. I said, Daddy, Daddy, tell me, how did you escape from prison? Apparently, he'd paid a parking ticket, and my grandfather had said, I guess you escaped prison this time. So I took it quite seriously. And when I met Master, I think I asked him more questions than anybody else did. So now you have your chance for revenge. Please ask your questions. And I need him to translate it from English into English because I'm stone deaf. Yeah. Okay, let's go home.
Okay. Thank you all for coming. Swamiji, we do have one. We have a few questions that were written in advance.
Okay.
The first.
Yes, let's ask this lady.
I can wait.
Yeah.
Good evening, Swami. Let's see. I am a working mother with two beautiful kids, a very sensitive 10-year-old boy and a very, very dominant 7-year-old girl. And my question is, this little girl, it seems, in a past life, has been a very powerful person, and she's more used to giving orders than taking direction. And I'm wondering if you have advice for people to parent these old souls who have different ideas without breaking their spirits.
I need help.
She has a sensitive 10-year-old boy and a domineering 7-year-old girl who seems to be an old soul who is more used to giving orders than taking direction. And she wonders if you have any advice for working with children who have these strong tendencies from the past.
You have to let them be themselves. You can't suppress them, but you can guide them. For example, you can help that dominating child to understand that when you dominate other people, you don't make them happy, and you yourself feel slightly uncomfortable. So tell her, try to be more sensitive to others' feelings, because she herself will find happiness through other people, the more she is sensitive to them. We have to understand that we are not this ego. We are God's dream, who dreamed us all. And this little ego is just that little part of the dream that makes us think we are ourselves. But in truth, as you advance spiritually, you begin to feel yourself one with everybody. And the more sensitive you are, that's why Jesus said, it is more blessed to give than to receive. More blessed because it's more blissful. When you give to other people, you expand your sensitivity and your happiness. And so let her try to understand that, and try to help her also to think in terms of giving more for her own sake. Any other questions? Yes.
Thank you, Swami. A couple years ago, I had an idea which came through me, and I decided to move forward with that, and I founded and launched a spiritual community in Los Angeles. And I always thought my role was just going to start this thing and then step back and allow others to participate in it and run it.
Just a moment, because I don't hear a word.
He had an idea some years ago to found a spiritual community in Los Angeles, which he has done. He always had felt that his role would be to get it going and then to step back and let others take over the leadership. Mm-hmm. That's halfway through.
However. Where I find myself is that it is actually, I can only feel as though my destiny that I step up as a spiritual leader and actually lean into leading this community, which is frightening for me. But I have been taking steps forward. My question in this is, a challenge I have often lies in really moving forward with an altruistic intention and releasing any egoic gain from being a leader in this community. And how can I best do this, releasing sort of any self-seeking from and truly creating a space of giving?
So he's now feeling that it is his destiny to step forward as the leader of the spiritual community. But one of the obstacles he's grappling with is, how does he lead in an altruistic way without the sense of ego coming in, of self-seeking and other things that can come with leadership?
That's a very difficult question. I, as you know, am the founder of communities. And I began them over 40 years ago, the first one. And it was no easy job. I, too, thought I could step back and let others take over, but it just doesn't work that way. If you have the idea to do it, think of leadership as a service. Don't think of it as a role. But unfortunately, you have to be very firm with people sometimes, because it's their egos that get in the way. They'll accuse you of ego because they have it. But if you think seriously that leadership is a service, still you have to be bossy to a certain extent. I remember there was one time at Ananda, and I had to finally call a meeting of the whole community. I said, every time I open my mouth, it's as if half of you jumped into it. I said that I'm tired of this. I like to give you a free rein, but I want you finally, if I say something strongly, I want you to accept it. And I said, if you don't, I'll just walk away and never look back. And half of them, 50 people left. But of course I'm not stupid, and I waited until I had the majority on my side. And so we from then on we've had harmony. And I still don't speak up strongly because we work together. But this constant bickering, and that I only had to open my mouth for many people to disagree, it just didn't work that way. So you have to be a strong leader. It doesn't have to be ego. It can be for a principle. And this is another leader of a community here in Los Angeles. You might like to get together and see what you can do together. Any other questions? Yes. Front.
Good evening, Swami. I recently found out that you were involved in a 12-year lawsuit. I myself right now am involved in a 2-year lawsuit, and I don't know when it's going to end. People are suing my partner and I. We made a film. It's claiming they made our film, and they did not, and all these lies and accusations and all that sort of stuff. So there are times where it's a very emotional roller coaster ride. What advice would you give to somebody who is going through a lawsuit of that nature, and what kept you going?
I might as well, instead of putting hearing aids in, put in hearing earplugs, but anyway.
she understands that Ananda was involved in a 12-year lawsuit. She has been involved in a 2-year lawsuit with people suing her to the rights to the film that she's made, and they are claiming that they made it when they didn't, and they are saying all kinds of lies against her and her partner.
And welcome to the club.
She wants to know, first of all, what advice would you give to somebody laboring in this kind of a situation, and also what kept you going through the 12 years of litigation?
Well, I knew that I was serving Master, and I knew I was doing his will. And I knew that the lawsuit in my case was entirely directed toward destroying me. And I just felt, well, I will be completely dharmic. Dharmic means to do the right thing in everything. There is a saying in India, yatha dharma satya jaya. Where there is dharma, where there is right action, there is victory and success. And our victory and success, or is victory? Never mind. And they had the third largest law firm in the world, plus they ended up with three more large law firms. My lawyer was a sole practitioner without even a secretary, but he was a man of righteousness. He believed in doing only what was right. And they told lie after lie after lie. It was incredible how many lies they told trying to win, but we remained absolutely truthful. in the end, we won on virtually everything. So I think be absolutely truthful. That's the main thing. Okay? Any other questions? There was one back there. Yes.
Yeah, hi. I wanted to ask you more about free will versus destiny. I remember you said last time that the only thing we have control over is our search for God. And I wanted to know if you can define our search for God. Does that mean to do good in the world and to be kind and compassionate and giving? Or is it more meditation and being in environments that, yeah.
She wanted to follow up on the question of how much free will do we have versus destiny. She remembers that you had said the only freedom we have is in our search for God. And she wanted to know if that means in our search for God we should lean more towards being serviceful and giving and compassionate outwardly towards others or more inwardly in meditation.
Anything you do that gets the whole thing on the spiritual path is getting rid of ego. So serving others is very much of a help. Now, there are different ways of serving people. For instance, I think many times that people will serve according to the way they've suffered in the past. Doctors often will be people who had great illness in the past and have compassion for people with illness. Psychiatrists are people who have probably been crazy before and aren't all that out of it. Aren't necessarily out of it yet. but excuse me if you're a psychiatrist. I have to have my fun too. But the thing is that there are various levels of service. You can give people money. But if they have money, they'll waste it after a while, spend it after a while. You can give them food, and they'll get hungry again in a few hours. Give them money, they'll at least be able to buy food. Give them happiness, which is what they want from everything, and that will be much more meaningful to them. And give them God, and you've given them the greatest gift of all. Because with the consciousness of God, you can be happy under all circumstances. So it depends on the level on which you're serving, but on all levels, service is a good thing because you're giving from your ego. Anything that you give from your ego, you expand your sense of selfhood to include other people. Finally, we have to understand. In fact, I had this dream in Florence, Italy, not very many years ago, that I saw crowds of people, mafioso businessmen, grasping businessmen, generous people, all kinds of people. And I saw that every one of them was really seeking happiness. They just maybe didn't know it. The mafiosi thought they would get it through revenge and power. The businessmen thought they'd get it through money and pleasure. But gradually, higher and higher octaves, but everybody was seeking that happiness. Why? Because we all come from God's bliss. We're all His dream. And when we understand that, I just came out of that dream understanding that this gave me a reason to love everybody in the world, because everybody really wants the same thing I want, God's bliss. They just don't know it. And so you have to feel even more love for them out of compassion that they don't know what they're looking for. But I see crowds of people in the streets and I just Sometimes I feel like weeping because everybody is my brother and sister. Any other questions? Yeah. I could probably hear you better without it.
Good evening, Swami. I have a two-part question. Whenever I hear these fundamentalist Christians, one just today said to me, well, this is the only way. It's eternal life through Jesus In other words, no matter what I said to her, she kept going back to her Bible and Jesus. We couldn't have an open discussion. So that's the first part. Oh, yes, and the question is, what advice...
You want to finish that? Let me answer the first?
He's getting to his question.
Okay, okay.
The question is, what advice can you give to as far as being able to handle such a suppressive, intimidating attitude?
His question is regarding fundamentalists, he said Christian in this case, who just today said to him, Jesus is the only way, and anything he tried to counter with, she just kept returning to that point. And his advice is, how do you deal with someone coming from such an oppressive point of view?
Stop making it oppressive. Yes, I love Jesus. I don't have to tell people who are that type that I love other great ones too. I love Jesus. He was a great son of God, a complete liberated soul, and I follow his teachings, and I am a Christian. In fact, I have written a book which I don't want to know myself as being the author. The author is just a Christian, and its name is Cooperating with Grace. And I show how, if you want to be a true Christian, I mean, if you think it's enough to just accept God, Christ, I mean, believe in him, that you'll go to heaven, well, I'd say lots of luck. But, I mean, after all, there are people who have believed in him who have committed great atrocities. Look at the Spanish Inquisition. Look at the Crusades. It isn't enough to believe. People believed that the world was flat. That didn't make it flat. And we have to have the experience of Christ's presence. Jesus gave us certain teachings. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Seek ye first the kingdom of God, and all these things shall be added unto you. He said many things that Christians don't even follow. And I would say, don't get into an argument with such people. Just bless them for what they have and say, I think you're doing a wonderful thing. I had somebody who was very dogmatically talking to me about his beliefs. I said, bless you for them. I had nothing. Why argue? Fools argue, wise men discuss. If they want to argue, let them argue. Okay.
Okay, the second part of the question is related. A scripture is often quoted. Jesus had said, nobody comes to the Father except through me. Just what did he mean by that?
When he said me, he was speaking of the only Son of God. He wasn't speaking of him as a man. Often we find in the Bible, he speaks the Son of Man and the Son of God. And because the people transcribing it didn't quite understand and got it a bit mixed up, sometimes they screwed it up. But when he spoke of the Son of God, he was speaking of that Christ consciousness to which he had attained. In other words, that me was not this I. The whole thing on the spiritual path is to get rid of the ego. And on this, in his life, he had completely overcome the ego, and he had become one with God. So what we have is the Trinity, Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. The Trinity is the Father is that infinite spirit out of which everything has come. The Holy Ghost is that vibration. We speak of it as the mother also. It's the mother aspect of God, but everything in creation, science has done us a great favor in proving that matter is really only a vibration of energy, and that energy is only a vibration of thoughts, and those thoughts are only a vibration of consciousness. Everything is God's consciousness, but we have not understood that, and we think that God is up there. He is in us. His consciousness created the very chairs you're sitting on, and he created you. And if you can get rid of your ego, you'll understand that he is your reality, not this little separate thinking that I am a separate man, I'm a woman, I'm an American, I'm a Frenchman, etc. So Jesus had reached that point, and this is the third thing. You have, just like the Father and mother in a family. Jesus is the Son. Jesus, the Christ consciousness, is the Son. In other words, in vibration, there is not a separation between the... This is deep stuff, and I hope you can get it. And if you can't, let me try again, but I think it's probably enough, and I hope not to put you to sleep. But where you've got vibration, you've got movement, don't you? And at the midpoint between that movement, you have Christ consciousness. In other words, the Spirit of God is reflected in every moving atom of creation. In every atom of creation, maybe at the center of that movement, there is that still reflection of the Father beyond creation. To that, Jesus had attained. And it was that he was speaking of when he spoke of being the Son of God. Okay?
Thank you.
Can I ask a follow-up question from someone online is asking, did Jesus teach yoga?
Well, Yogananda said he practiced Kriya Yoga or something very similar. You know, a very interesting thing in Spain, they have a tradition that Jesus' last movement on the cross was to go like this. That is exactly the movement of a higher initiation of Kriya Yoga when you want to leave the body. Very interesting that they had that. At any rate, Jesus, certainly when he spoke of the keys of the kingdom, those keys are yoga. Yoga is not a weird science. Yoga is simply cooperating with grace. It says that this is the way grace moves, so this is how we should be. And that grace moves up the spine if you meditate deeply. And so try to raise the energy in the spine. The energy when you get involved in things. You know, the heart is the main thing, and women in this sense are closer to God. But the trouble is women get emotional. And there was a man who said, the trouble with women is they take everything personally. And this woman said, nonsense, I don't. Well, unfortunately, we have to go beyond that thought of personal and reactive thing. When we can go beyond that reaction, and this is what yoga teaches you, then you become absolutely calm. That is true intuition. And so with intuition, women are closer to intuition. I know that many times a man will tell his wife that he's got a new partner, and she'll say, I don't trust him. And he say, what do you mean? He's came with impeccable credentials. 2 years later, he walks off with all the money. So this is a quality that women have more than men. Intuition can also be reason, but reason tends to break things up, and men go more by reason. And this is why it's wise to listen to your wife when she's not emotional. Any other questions?
Swami, accepting that our purpose is to awaken from the illusion of separation into a state of oneness with God, what was the cause of the original separation?
Accepting that our life's purpose is to wake up from the illusion of separateness from God, what was the initial cause of that first separation?
You know, that is Satan. Satan exists. He's a power. He's that outward thrusting power from God to create the universe. The question, why did God create the universe, has been answered variously. Even Sri Yukteswar said, leave some questions to be answered when you reach God. But I've come up with a very good answer to it. Because Master Shankaracharya said that he defined God as Satchidananda, and Master translated that as ever-existing, ever-conscious, and then he added, ever-new bliss. Well, that ever-new bliss, the nature of bliss, is to want to keep expressing itself in new ways. And thus, from that, it's the very nature of God to want to express himself as the universe. But that power of Satan is a reality in this universe, and if you go toward him, he will pull you more toward him. If you go more toward God, he will pull you more. God will pull you more toward him. So it's very important never to play with delusion. Don't think, well, I can drink it, I'm above that. I can indulge in these things, I'm above that. Don't get fooled. That power is very, very great. Don't play with temptation, and you will be free. But always think, God is your power. It's really, you know, everything finally is grace. When you have the sunlight on the side of a building, you don't invite the sunlight to shine, it just shines. But you can decide whether you want the curtains of your room to be closed or open. If you want to close them, fine, the sun won't come in. If you want to open them, it's up to you. So we have to do our part with grace by opening ourselves to grace. See that? Yes. There are two of you right in a row. That's all right. That's okay.
Hi, Swamiji. The last time I had the, well, I guess it was the time before that, the last time I asked you to sing or to say in Yogananda's voice some things, we were celebrating his life at the Ananda Ashram. This is probably too much. It was about that I was realizing that I lived so much in delusion, and you answered, don't we all? So I felt very comforted by that. My question is, to know God, when I move in deeply into meditation, I know that it's to love God with all my heart and all my mind and all my strength. But I recently did a workshop, a Gestalt training, that shows that I have blocks based on being raised by my mother and her raised by her mother that don't allow me really to receive love. And I've learned that if we can't receive love, how can I give love? And that I'm controlled by these ways of surviving in the world based on how I was raised. Okay. Does that make sense?
Please excuse me if you have to listen to these questions twice, but I can't hear a word.
Okay.
So he had asked you a question in a previous satsang or expressed this feeling that visiting the Ananda Ashram in L.A., he realized how much he himself lived in delusion, and you answered, don't we all? But his question is that although he wants to be open to God, and forgive me, Jim, I'm paraphrasing, and to feel God's love and express God's love, he recently went through a workshop that revealed to him that he had blockages because of his upbringing, in particular the way his mother raised him, that blocked him in receiving love. And his question is, how can I give love if I have a block in receiving love? Is that accurate?
You know, that's the whole thing of delusion. We have all these blocks, and we have to gradually untie all of them. Yeah. It would be so easy if we say, okay, now I love God. Okay, but it's not so easy, because you've got all these subconscious things, blocks, desires, attachments, all these self-definitions. We have to get rid of all our self-definitions. It is a lifetime job. In fact, I once asked Master, have I been your disciple for thousands of years? He said, it's been a long time, that's all I'll say. I said, does it always take so long? He said, oh yes, desires for name and fame and things take people away again and again. I suppose he was naming those two particular delusions because they had been mine. Fortunately, now I have not those delusions. But we have to work hard. It's no easy job. And those blocks, how to get rid of them? Give everything to God. One trick that I have had is at night, I build a bonfire mentally, and then mentally throw all my attachments and desires into that fire and just watch them burn up and feel joy in the being rid of those things. Another time when I came to Yogananda, I've always been intelligent, but I was a little bit proud of my intelligence. And I saw that as a block and I couldn't get rid of it. And one day in meditation, I just said, I'm tired of this. And I just threw it. I said, get out, like that, with all the power at my disposal. And I just felt free from it. And I came out of my meditation. I saw Master standing above the tennis court. And I went to get his blessing. And he blessed me. He said, very good. And from then on, I've never had that. So this is the way, I think, with sometimes we have to do violence with ourselves. Okay?
It's just a process that will take time, and we will see things as we're going.
It does take time, but yeah. You know, Master said to me once, habits can be destroyed in a day. You're thinking one way, just think another way. That's all there is.
Yeah.
But usually it takes time. Still with vigor, we can get rid of them immediately, as I did that day. Mm-hmm. One time there was a man I read about, he was an alcoholic. And he had a cupboard full of whiskey and gin and all those things. And he gave it up. But after a while, he found himself going to the closet and opening up a bottle. And he was just about to drink it. And he said, no! And he took all his bottles and threw them on the sidewalk, broke every one of them. And that violence was enough to get rid of that desire. So often with violence, we can get rid of our... But that's not the only way. One way is by non-attachment, by seeing that even while you indulge in a delusion, this is not me, I don't want this. Gradually, by mental detachment, you can free yourself. Okay?
Thank you, Swami.
Yeah, somebody behind you had a question.
Hi. So I actually have two questions. First one, based on what you were saying a few minutes ago about consciousness, why is it that...
Could you speak up, please?
I'm sorry. Based on what you were saying a few minutes ago about consciousness, why is it that people often refer to God as a he or himself? Because it seems like that's kind of confusing. If it's a consciousness, then it wouldn't have a gender-specific term.
Okay, so he said, in terms of speaking of consciousness as you were recently, why refer to God as he? Because it seems that consciousness would transcend any gender.
I think of he because that's the Western and particularly the Christian tradition. But I myself worship God as the Divine Mother. In fact, I had a very wonderful experience once. I was inspired by Divine Mother to go back to India after 10 years. And I had enough money to go for 2 months and come back. But as I drove into San Francisco a couple of weeks before I was to leave for India, and my rod in the car, whatever it is rods do, I don't know enough about cars to say. Anyway, I obviously had to get a new car. And I tried to pray, and I couldn't go to any church and kneel down. All the doors were locked, and I couldn't really pray in a restaurant. Finally, I had to say to Divine Mother, look, my common sense tells me I need a new car when I come back. I have to come back from India. You will have to see to it that I get enough money to go to India. That's the way I prayed. And I bought the car, a good used car, for $1,700, $1,800, and put down $1,100 of my own money, and then the money I got back from the old car. And that was Friday evening. So Monday morning, I got a letter in the mail with a check for $1,000, and the letter said, it was made out to me, not to Ananda, and it said, use this as Divine Mother wants you to. Mm-hmm. Now, how many people in America think of God as Divine Mother? How many people know that I think of God as Divine Mother? He was a stranger to me, but I took that as a real miracle of Divine Mother. Divine Mother is, in a way, closer to us than the Father. She is more forgiving, and like a Negro in court one time, when the judge asked him, how do you plead? He said, Your Honor, I pleads for mercy. And I think we need mercy. So anyway.
I guess then, why even assign a gender to it at all, then? Even assign a gender at all?
He said, in that case, why even assign a gender at all?
Because we are human beings, If we were cockroaches, we might pray differently. But as human beings, it's more natural for us to think of consciousness encased in a human form. And God can come to us in whatever form we pray. There is a saint in India, his name was Ram Prasad, lived in the 18th century. And he used to pray to the Divine Mother as the Divine Mother. And he was out working on the fence of his property and saying, Amundin Kihobe Matara. And his daughter, as it looked like, came and played with him. And she said, Daddy, why are you keeping praying to Divine Mother? He said, well, I keep praying to her, but she never answers. And the daughter said, well, if you keep calling and she doesn't answer, why do you bother to call her? And she ran away laughing. And he finished his job, and he went inside, and he mentioned how their daughter had come and helped him with the fence. And his wife said, that's not possible. She's on the other side of town. And he, when the daughter came home, he said, weren't you with me this afternoon? She said, no, Daddy, you can ask anybody. I was on the other side of town. Then he knew it was the Divine Mother. But the Divine Mother answers your questions. You can pray to God as the infinite, but it's very hard to have devotion to an abstraction. And without devotion, you cannot find God. You cannot think your way to God. There has to be this longing for him. It's like living next door to a famous restaurant, knowing everything they serve, knowing their whole menu, but not being hungry, so you won't go in. Devotion is Sirik Teshur, who is a saint of wisdom. He said the first and most important thing on the spiritual path is to have devotion. And you can have devotion to wisdom, but it's harder. That's all. It's only to make it easier. Okay. It's a pleasant myth that you create for yourself.
Okay. I had another question, and this is something I've actually wanted to ask you for a long time. And you or Yogananda, what he would have thought. But is there an opinion of where dreams come from and what they mean?
On where what? Dreams. Oh, where do dreams come from and?
And the meaning.
Okay, his question is, where do dreams come from and what do they mean?
They come mostly from the subconscious. Sometimes we get them from the superconscious. Mostly they have no meaning. They're just a sort of a hodgepodge replay of what's been thrown into your subconscious. But the subconscious is more open to the superconscious. And so sometimes a dream will come to you which comes from above. I'll give you an example. Because I was thrown out of SRF on my ear and I'm no longer a member of SRF, I love them. I have nothing against it. I just feel God did that to me for a good reason, and I know what that reason is. I've been able to do the work I was told by my guru to do. But the thing is that I don't have access to their archives. I worked with Master on his Bhagavad Gita. He told me one of my duties in this life was editing. How could I edit a book that I didn't have the actual manuscript for? But I did work with him on it. And I remember actually saying to him, Master, this is the most wonderful thing I've ever read in my life. But when SRF's version came out, I was very dissatisfied. It was, Master's version was easy to read. Theirs was impossible to read. They made even serious philosophical mistakes. And I wanted so much to write something that he really said. And I asked Master in a dream once, how can I get at them, at those archives? And he said, don't overlook the possibility of a skylight. And years later, when I was trying to work on his Gita, trying to just at least remember what I could remember, suddenly I found I remembered the entire Gita. I had worked with him on it, I knew it all. But I remembered stanza for stanza, every sloka. And I wrote that whole thing in less than 2 months, 600 pages. It just flowed out of me. So that was an example of a superconscious dream. Sometimes we do have those. Usually there has to be a sense of calmness. If there's fear or emotion, then it won't be a superconscious dream. But that's the answer to your question. Okay? Yes.
Is it okay?
Okay, you're beaten.
Yeah, Om Namah Shivaya. You spoke a little bit about my question about attachment. I've tried to be a vegetarian. Sometimes I last months, sometimes weeks, sometimes days. How important is it to be a vegetarian and still have ascension to higher consciousness?
She said, is it possible? Is it to be a vegetarian?
She's tried repeatedly and with different levels of success.
Is that it?
Yes, that's part of it. And then this, you spoke about Jesus, and I had been reading about his life, and I don't know if you know about this, or you can speak to whether it's fact or somebody made it up or even know the answer, that after he, I guess the word, left his body on the cross, that he really didn't leave his body. He came back, and he was taken back to India. In hiding, I don't know if that's even true, but I wanted to know if you knew about this. Thank you.
Can you help?
Let's do the vegetarian one first.
Well, the vegetarian question, she mentioned Jesus. Jesus said, I have meat to eat that you know not of. He ate meat. That was the way people were dreaming in those days. Master himself, in first coming to this country, he himself was vegetarian. But he didn't talk much about not eating meat. He said, don't eat beef or veal or ham. He said, these are the worst. But he allowed people to eat chicken, lamb, fish. Then later on, he recommended not to eat those. For us who came toward the end of his life, I was with him only 3.5 years, he was very strict about it. He said, don't eat any kind of meat. The reason for not eating meat is only partly that it's against ahimsa or nonviolence. You have to kill animals to eat them. But it's more than that. It's a matter of consciousness. When you kill a plant, obviously it may be a fantasy on my part, but I think the plants are happy to serve by giving themselves to eat. But especially the pigs and cows, they have a higher consciousness. And people have told me that are on the route to the slaughterhouse that the cows, when they're going by there, the sound they make is one of intense fear. They know they're going to be killed. They die with fear, with anger. And that vibration is left in the meat. And it has a lingering effect. It'll affect you. You will be... if you eat meat, you will be much more irascible. For somebody on the spiritual path, it's a very good thing never to eat beef. Yogananda said another thing. He said that he went into the slaughterhouses and he saw them scooping cancer out of the beef. That means that you're eating cancerous meat. That is a very bad thing to do, isn't it? He said the reason that ham has such a sweet taste is because of this pus in it. Well, these are not pleasant thoughts. So he did recommend that you give up those. But if you have to eat meat, chicken and veal, and not veal, sheep and fish, they're less conscious. I remember when I was 5 or 6 years old, my father took me out on Lake Snagov in Romania, and we went fishing. And when we pulled up two little fish wriggling, I felt so badly for those poor fish. I never wanted to go fishing again. But they don't feel it as badly. Still, a vegetarian diet for somebody who is on the spiritual path is definitely helpful. It's also been found, and I've read this several times recently in newspapers, that people who eat meat, especially red meat, they die sooner. If you want to live a longer life, better not eat meat. I sometimes worry because I don't eat meat and I'm 86, and how long has it got to go? Anyway, your other question?
Her second question was, were you familiar with the tradition that after Jesus died on the cross, he didn't actually die but returned to his body and then was taken to India?
I have heard that. I don't believe it. I don't believe it because of visions of people like Teresa Neumann, who Master said she was Mary Magdalene, and she had visions of him dying. So I don't believe it, but I can't say dogmatically or assertively. I don't know. I know there have been things filmed in India, but Master said that Jesus did go to India. The 18 years, you know, all we have in the Bible is at the age of 12, he's talking to the rabbis, and at the age of 30, he comes back and talks to his disciples. But there are 18 years there that are carefully left undone. Nobody says anything about them. If they had not taken it out, you'd think they would at least have been something like he grew up and worked in his father's shop. People think he was a carpenter. He wasn't. Whatever his father was, he did go to India, and he, Master, when I had been with Master only a month, maybe less than a month, when he had me out of the desert, and he was dictating his lessons. He was not pleased with his lessons, and he wanted to dictate new ones, but it became too much for him, and he stopped. But anyway, in this first lesson, he said the three wise men were Lahiri, Babaji, Lahiri Mahashai, and Sri Yukteswar. It makes you wonder, who is Master? Not a question I can answer, because I asked Master once, were you Jesus Christ? And he said, what difference would it make? So, what can you say? But anyway, he went back to those masters who had come to him. You know, it says that they saw his star in the east. Well, they saw it in the east, but he was going westward, weren't they? So it wasn't westward outwardly. This is the east of the body, the point between the eyebrows. This is the north. Base of the spine is the south. Medulla oblongata is the waist. And they saw that east star when the spiritual eye is a golden sphere with a blue field inside and a five-pointed star in the center. It's what many people see. I have not seen it. That's my bad fortune. I've seen a little bit, but somehow God has kept these things from me. Nonetheless, I remember in Italy we wanted to have a spiritual eye for our altar, and we went to somebody in Merano where they make glass, and we asked him to do a design of this. He said, what is this? I've been seeing it all my life, and I don't know what it is. But many people have seen this that I've talked to. And that star in the center, the first thing is golden sphere is this golden light of the astral world. Then the blue light of the causal world, the five-pointed star is the Godhead. When you go through this five-pointed star, you go into Christ, into God consciousness. And so the meaning of this is that Jesus, when they saw his star in the east, they meant they had seen an avatar. They had seen an incarnation of God being born on this earth, and they were coming to salute him and greet him. It doesn't mean they were prostrating themselves. They were one with that. But they came to bless it and welcome it into this world. Any other questions?
Excuse me for 1 second. Out of fairness to everyone, if you could confine your two or three or four-part question to one part, I think it would be the best use of time.
Hi, Swamiji. As you know, I'm related to Yogananda Roma is my great-grandmother. And I often wonder how he dealt with the separation from his family And did he communicate with them often? Or, I mean, they didn't have cell phones back then. So how did he deal with the separation from his family?
He is Yogananda's great-grandnephew.
I know.
And his question is, how did Yogananda deal with the separation from his family and the difficulty in communicating with them without cell phones and so on?
I would love to know the answer to that question. I have family, and almost none of them are sympathetic to what I'm doing. Just a part of the game. Jesus said, who is my father and mother and brother and sister except those who love God? How could Yogananda? But he had love for them anyway, as I have love. Some of them were more in tune than others. But here's a very interesting thing. He said that once you achieve final liberation, once any soul achieves final liberation, all of his family, 7 generations forward and backward, will achieve freedom. I asked a great saint in India what that meant, and he explained that when one becomes emperor, it doesn't mean everybody else becomes emperor, but all his family is somehow lifted socially according to their own spiritual receptivity. And so to be born in the family, nephews, very few saints have children, but they have nieces and nephews and cousins and so on. 7 generations forward and back receive a great blessing. So you were very fortunate. Any other questions?
We have a question from the audience someone submitted anonymously. Can you please discuss the notion of needing a guru and following a disciplined path versus a person needing to be a light within oneself? Or does one just humble down and not question if one is so blessed to already sense Master's presence so strongly?
Jesus said, ye shall know the truth, and he spoke about truth. You have to seek truth if you're going to seek God. And if you want the truth, you have to ask questions. And that means that you need somebody who can answer them wisely. I never in my life met anybody I considered wise enough to tell me authoritatively what the truth was. And so I never thought of going to a teacher. But I've reached the point in my own seeking when I realized that I just didn't know the truth. I couldn't find it anywhere. I didn't find it in myself. I needed help. And when I reached that point, I found the autobiography. I read it. I took the next bus from New York to Los Angeles. I was accepted by Master that same meeting, and I've been his disciple ever since. But I think that when you are ready, you don't have to shop the counter. You don't have to look for him. He will come to you. And when you really want God and you want the truth, God will send you him who is destined to help you. Meanwhile, you can go to books. Meanwhile, you can go to teachers and different things. I had the good fortune of not knowing anything. Sometimes when you learn a lot, you have to get rid of a lot of misconceptions before you can learn even from a true guru. But I didn't know anything. I never had heard of Indian philosophy or gurus or anything. When I read Master's book, that was my exposure, my first exposure. And I was fortunate in that. I remember after meeting him, I was a very questioning person. And I would have to sit down every 15 minutes to calm my mind because all these questions that kept going. But finally, I got all my answers. And I got to spend many, many hours with him alone where he talked to me about teachings. I got to ask him more questions, I think, than anybody else ever did. But as far as his being my guru, I just knew. How do you know? Yeah, certain things you know. How do you know you're alive? Descartes was completely wrong when he said, I think, therefore I am. Rather, he should have said, I am, and I'm aware of being, and that's why I think. And that certain awareness that you are living, no, it's not because you think, you just know you're alive. And I knew he was my guru. It's that simple for me. Any other questions?
Yes, can you speak to the correlation between our expectations of others in the sense of loyalty of others and the pursuit of non-attachment in the context of a personal relationship or our friends or with friends?
What did he say?
Sorry about that.
Speak up, please.
Okay.
Sorry.
I have stage issues, yeah. So the concept of our expectations of loyalty from others.
Our expectations of loyalty from others versus.
Versus the pursuit of non-attachment.
The pursuit of non-attachment.
In the context of personal relationships and friends.
And friends.
That's a tough one and a good one. Because naturally we want our friends to be loyal. The first thing is to be loyal to them. But I was very loyal to SRF, and yet they threw me out. I felt that they had betrayed me. And for many years, I had to suffer the deep hurt of their betrayal. What finally brought me to a point of freedom, was knowing that they didn't do it. God did it through them. It was something that had to be done to me for my own liberation. So I'm grateful for everything. But people will betray you. This is one of the great pains in life, when our dear friends betray us. There was a boy in Bucharest. He lived in the slums. I felt very sorry for him. They didn't even have window panes. They only had newspapers for windows. And he would come to my house, and I'd feel so sorry for him. I'd give him my toys and do anything I could for him. One day, he and a few friends called me into a courtyard and locked the gate and began kicking a football at me, trying to get up the energy to beat me up. And I just knocked the football down, and finally they let me out. But I was so hurt that this dear friend would betray my love for him in that way. It's just the sort of thing we all have to put up with at one time. I think the first and most important thing is not to say to the world, well, I'll show you. Always be loyal yourself. Always give people your love, even if they hate you. I remember there was one man at Mount Washington who used to say, I don't know why I hate you, Don, but I do. I would say, I don't hate you. I don't know what I can say to you. But we have to be that ourselves. And we have to realize that this world, it's always going to be a mixed bag. Everything we have to give to God. Everything that comes to us comes from God. And we have to accept it in the end gratefully, because it will have taught us something important. And that important thing is not that people are no damn good, but that we must remain even-minded always. Yes. Back there?
I was wondering, how can you love those you're in conflict with, and how can you be a strong, effective leader with no ego?
How can you love those whom you're in conflict with, and how can you be a strong, effective leader with no ego?
You can be the best leader if you don't have ego. I've had to be a leader all my life. I have found that being a leader is a position of service. And yes, I have to stand strong about certain things, but I think of principle, not of me. And when I built Ananda, I built it as a community for master. And many times people would have other ideas and get in conflict with me. I had to be firm on that. But I didn't take it personally. It was my principles I was standing for. Otherwise, as a leader, the most important thing, and I in fact don't appoint people in our community as leaders if they have strong egos. If they want to serve, they are appointed as leaders. So I have written a book called The Art of Supportive Leadership. And it's some large companies like Kellogg and others. In fact, the U.S. Army has bought it for training their officers. How to be a leader as a service to others is a very important thing. I would recommend reading that book, because, of course, I can't explain the whole book in a one answer to a question. In fact, I can't even remember all of it. But try that. Another question. Yes.
Thank you. When we were talking about dreams, I have dreams of shortly after the people in my life that I've loved when they die, and they always come to me and let me know they're okay or give me words of wisdom, help me. But I had a dream the other night, and I had a brother I lost in 2009, and he was sick 16 days. He found out he had a melanoma and died within 16 days. And he's always on the earth. And I had a dream the other night, and he was calling me on the phone. And he said, "I'm so lonely." And I said, "I can't hear you very well. Where are you?" And he said, "I'm hiding in the closet. I don't want them to hear me." And I said, "Well, tell me where you are so I can come and see you." And then I lost the connection. And I was wondering if you think people ever get earthbound, or they don't know how to make that transition because they didn't really mean to leave?
She has had several dreams when loved ones in her life have passed, where they have come to her just after their passing to reassure
people her. People who are in the other world do sometimes come to us in our dreams. It's not an imagination.
No, that's... But I have another...
She had her brother, though, who suddenly, within 16 days, realized he had a melanoma and died 16 days later. And he, to her, still feels like he's on this earth. She had a dream recently where he was calling her on the phone saying, "I feel so alone." And she said, "Where are you?"
Send him your love. Send him your support. Tell him there's a higher world to go to. People do have that problem. And do pray for him.
To help him move forward.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, any other questions? Do make them short, because we... Okay, you?
Was this the very room where there was a dinner, the big dinner before Master passed away?
No, it was out there in the lobby, believe it or not. You'll see that thing there. I went to the reception today and I said, "I was here that day when he left his body. I was at that function."
Wow. Thank you.
Yeah. Any other? Yes, June.
In the Bible, it says that the meek will inherit the earth. Who are the meek, and when will that happen? And if it will happen soon, what does soon mean?
Now, there's a true brother with a deep, deep voice like mine.
In the Bible, it says the meek will inherit the earth. Who are the meek? When will?
When you see the hangdog expression of what we would call meek people, you don't see them inheriting the earth. So by meek, he had to have another meaning than that word has taken on in recent years, where meek people sort of always trying to get out of the way. No, a meek person has to be somebody who is open to God and letting God do things through him. And they inherit the earth, because when you're in tune with God, everything comes to you. Jesus said, "Seek the kingdom of God first, and all these things shall be added unto you." So it is a true saying, but unfortunately language changes. Any other questions?
I'd like to ask you, Swami, when you reach a level where you feel purity within you and you feel happy and content with life, but sometimes in solitude you find that, and then when you get out into the world you can share it, but the environment can affect you. What helps you out to come back to that light and not get so sunk into what is going on around you?
Sometimes in solitude you can feel a purity and a happiness that then once you go out into the outer environment that you can start to lose that.
I recommend solitude for everybody. 1 or 2 weeks a year. Go away and don't talk to anybody. Don't say a word. And spend your time meditating. This will be the most precious time in your life. And yes, when you come out of that, the whole storm comes in again, but it'll help you. Year by year, it will help you. I can say that the happiest times in my life have been times when I was in seclusion. And don't let anybody speak. Just be completely alone. A good place to go for seclusion is the desert. There's a certain calmness. I think of deserts as places that are purifying. And I used to go out to 21 Palms. Wonderful. But in India, I used to go up to Lohar Ghat, which is in the foothills of the Himalayas. And I would spend time there. I remember one time I was there for 2 weeks. It was the hardest thing in the world to leave. I just felt I could spend the rest of my life there. But I had to come out. Still, do that. Make it a practice spiritually, because it's a very important thing. Yes.
How do you balance egolessness without losing the unique spark that God wishes to express like a snowflake as you?
How do you balance egolessness with the unique spark like a snowflake that God wishes to express through you?
You know, there's a very interesting... I've written a book. It's called The Time Tunnel. And in this book, you go through this tunnel and reach a point of timelessness. And from that point, you can go forward and backward in time. And they go back all the way. The first thing he did was go back to the Mesozoic era with dinosaurs. But they also go forward. And in one of them, they go forward to a high spiritual age. And there, they find that everybody is out of the ego and yet completely different. You know, you are unique. God has expressed himself uniquely through you. He has a particular song to sing through you. And when you are in ego, you are always imitative. You act like an American because you're an American. You act like a man because you're a man. You act like a wealthy man because that's how wealthy men are supposed to be. You act all these false definitions. When you get rid of the ego, you have a unique quality that God has a special song to sing through every soul, and try to ask him, what is it that you want me to do in this world? But you will see that the wonderful thing is, everybody, when he finds God, is unique. He's not a faceless being. Any other questions? Yes. Yes.
Could you speak something about love between two people and how that container can be used as an aid in spiritual search?
I'm sorry, say again?
Could you speak something about love between two people and how that container be useful in spiritual search? Like, how can exclusivity not hamper the soul?
Can you speak about the love between two people and how that can be used as an aid in the spiritual search?
Love between most people is not love. Most human love is selfish. What you are getting, you're thinking in terms of that rather than what you're giving. If you can really see, and this is what they say in the Indian marriage ceremony, that the wife should love the husband, not for the sake of the husband, but for the sake of God who is in the form of that husband. And the husband should love the wife in the same way. And we should see everybody as an instrument of God. And you will find that kind of love is self-purifying. But if you love people for what you can get out of them, then that's ego. If you love them for what you can give, that is divine. And the trouble with human love is that it's almost always ego. Try to see God in everybody, and you will become freed. I have seen that now after many years, and I just love people for the God in them. It's a wonderful feeling. Any other question? Yes, just a minute.
It's a little uncomfortable for me asking this because I'm not sure how to ask it. I received a feeling of cold air, chills, and then emotion inside that brought tears to my eyes, like we were friends in a past life. Can you explain?
What do you think?
He received a feeling of cold chills and then tears, and he suddenly felt that you and he were friends in a past life. Could you explain?
You know, you've all been my friends in the past life. Truly. I was in a session in India called We the People, in which they wanted to attack me. And I felt that everybody in that audience, there were 100 people, I felt they were all friends and relatives of mine from the past. And Master wrote in his autobiography that one reason we should love everybody is that everyone, at one time or another, has been close to us. That's an amazing statement. That means we've been coming a long time. But the truth is that is a reality. We've all known each other. And the more spiritually advanced you become, the more you actually recognize people, not specifically, oh, that's Aunt Charlie, and whatever it is, not Charlie, but something. And it's not that. But you just have this feeling, I know that person, and I feel that way. And it's a beautiful feeling, and I do feel that.
How do I explain that the cold chill that comes in me and the tears that come to my eye, and it's only happened twice, and that's to meet you?
How can you explain that the feeling came as a cold chill and then tears coming to his eyes?
Because there was love, and is love. Any other questions?
This woman here.
Yes. Yeah, you had a question? Okay.
Hello. And
well,
thank you.
Now we've got somebody else.
Oh, thank you for being here with us. I have a question about what your opinion is about life on other planets. Are we alone in our solar system, or is there more than we can see?
What is your opinion on life on other planets? Are we alone?
Oh, naturally there's life on other planets. I mean, it would be absurd that God would create this vast universe and only have people scrambling around on this planet. There are plenty of planets to go to, and I asked Master this question once. In a higher yuga, higher age, will the same people be coming back? He said, oh no, you go where you are drawn by your own nature. There are many planets to go to. This universe is fully populated. So, yes, yes. There's a lady in front here.
Swamiji, you've spoken about how you were riddled with doubt. Was this before you met Master or after? And
before and after.
Okay, so how did you overcome that?
I overcame my doubts. Mind you, here, a question was asked and I understood it. Yay! I found that by love of him, I overcame all doubts. And I think love is the supreme answer to doubt. If you love God, what is there to bother about doubting? So love God, love God, love God. Any other questions? Yes.
I'm sorry, ma'am. Yeah. You asked a question already?
Yes, I did.
Yeah, let's have other people have a chance.
Okay.
Yeah.
Over here?
Sorry.
Over here.
There's another man next.
Om Swami.
Over here.
Hello. My question is, what is the nature of human depression, and from standpoint of spirituality, how to overcome it?
What is the nature of human depression, and from the point of view of spirituality, how to overcome it?
You know, thoughts are not your own. Your thoughts are not your own. We're sort of, actually, this is something science itself is beginning to question. We don't create our thoughts. We are transmitting stations for those thoughts. Yogananda wrote in his autobiography, thoughts are universally, not individually rooted. And It depends on the level of consciousness on which you have your mind. If your mind is low, on a low level in your spine, let's say, then you will be depressed. If you put your mind here very strongly, then you'll suddenly come out of this depression. I remember once, I was still 22 when I met Master, and I remember one time suddenly going into a mood, and I tried reasoning with it, and all my reason always follows feeling. And so when my feeling, because my feeling was down, my reason gave me all the justification in the world for feeling down. So I thought, well, I asked my subconscious mind, do you like this? And the answer came, no. I said, well, boys, what do we do about it? So I said, all right, we'll sit down and meditate. And I put my mind here very strongly. And it was all that it took was 5 minutes. I just felt suddenly different. I felt all the reason why these things should be and so on. But it depends on where your mind is centered. So lift the center. Otherwise, don't try to reason your way out of it. Okay, any more? Yes.
Martha.
Hello, Swamiji. Thank you so much. I wanted to know what you think about the end of the Mayan calendar coming up December 21st.
What?
What do you think about the end of the Mayan
calendar? I don't know, but I'm very interested.
We'll find out.
There was somebody in Switzerland who told me that between October and December of this year, there is supposed to be a very great solar flare, much greater than they've had since they discovered electricity and started beginning using electricity. And this could easily knock out all the electricity in this world. Who knows? Yogananda said in church one day, you don't know what a terrible cataclysm is coming. So something interesting is in the air. And I would say it could be. I would at least try to get land in the country. And you listen, when, I mean, here I am in Los Angeles. I know that I'm in a difficult position to say this, but I have to say it conscientiously. If there is a serious depression, and we're coming to one that Master said would be greater than the 1930s, what will happen if food trucks come to the outside of the city? People will stop them from coming in. People in the grocery stores right now, if they come late in the afternoon, there are many things they can't get. How will it be at the if that should happen? You won't get food in the inner cities. What will you do? That will be only part of it. But Master is speaking of a cataclysm. That seems like something more than man-made. That could be what I said about the solar flare. It could be also some heavenly body hitting the earth. I don't know. But I think the Mayan prophecy is something to be listened to. Okay.
Thank you.
Any others? Yes, there's one over here.
Technology.
Swami, I was with SRF for a short time, used to go there, and then I heard about Ananda and I felt a great opening.
Can you tell me that much?
He used to go to SRF, he was there for a short while, then he heard about Ananda and felt a great opening.
And innocence and truthfulness, which came from Ananda.
And innocence and truthfulness which came from Ananda.
So I've now seen that there's quite a lot of ritual, and not nearly as much as SRF, but there is ritual. And there are certain things which might repel a person from joining an organization. So since pure being is very easy to know and to be, and it can be taught all over the world very quickly, what can Ananda do to help pure consciousness to spread worldwide, and so that people stop thinking that happiness comes from consuming things? happiness is our nature, and we need to get that out, and Ananda could play a good role in this. What can we do?
He's also seen that there is a bit of ritual at Ananda, and there is also things that might repel one from joining a particular organization. What can Ananda do to spread pure consciousness all over the world?
Master started some rituals. Rituals are a way of bringing people's devotion instead of just talking about abstract truths. If you have a certain amount of ritual, it can bring people's devotion to a focus too. I have written a number of rituals. I've written for marriage, for death, for birth, for I don't know what else. I'm not very organizational in my mind, but I have found that these things are helpful. We have a purification ceremony, and we have a festival of light every Sunday at our services, which is sort of our equivalent of the Catholic thing where we speak of inner communion rather than outer. But these rituals are helpful, but I do say the most important, in fact, really the only important thing is inner communion. And I have not followed the way of SRF because I've tried to follow the way of Master as he has told me. And I've seen them go away from quite a few things he taught, but nonetheless, I've tried to adhere to those. I'm not Advaitin. Advaitin is the pure truth, but we have to have form before we reach formlessness. And I think in that form, we need forms that uplift, and the ceremonies are a way of uplifting our consciousness. Okay? Okay, I think we have time for two more questions, okay? Back there.
Hello. I'd like you to speak a little bit about purpose. What we see a lot of people writing and speaking about, all the modern day gurus, find your purpose in 7 steps or 3 steps or however many steps. Is it true that we are perfectly serving exactly where we are? Or should we be concerned in, oh, I've got to find that purpose that where I'm going to serve best?
Could you speak about purpose? Is it true that wherever we are serving perfectly, or should we have a concern to find our true purpose?
We should have a concern to find our true purpose. And that purpose, okay, you have a man who's very good at acting, but if it goes to his head, that is not a dharmic thing. He should try to do something that will help him above all to get rid of his ego. So think in terms of how you can serve others. That's the first consideration. Second consideration, will it involve my ego? Or will I be able to do it with less sense of ego? That's the third one. Third one is, can it help me to love people more? Everything in business even should be finally done for love of people and serving people. And those who do that will be more successful. One more question. There was a gentleman here.
Thank you, Swami. First of all, before I ask my question, I know what's going to happen in 2012. So if you're interested, ask Dharma Raj, and he'll tell you. My first question is, are you the reincarnation of Sanjay?
Are you the reincarnation of Sanjaya?
Who is Sanjay?
The Bhagavad Gita.
I know. You know, it's an interesting question, so I certainly ask questions myself. But the first question is what?
That was the first question.
Oh, you have a second question?
Your second question, you know...
Listen, I've been the incarnation of a lot of people.
Second question.
I'm just glad to get out of it all. I think I was Henry I of India and Alfonso X of Spain, and I think I was lived in the time of Kurukshetra. But at that time of Kurukshetra, when Sanjay was living, I was the ruler of a small kingdom, and I gave my kingdom to my son when the battle of Kurukshetra began and went out into the forest and took initiation as a disciple of a great guru at that time. So no, I was not Sanjay.
Okay. A second question. Yogananda talked about different people being different manifestations again. And when you look at the history of the avatars, they always bring somebody along. So the question I have is, if Yogananda was Arjuna, did he say anything about Krishna coming?
That when you look at the avatars, they always bring others along with them. And if Yogananda was in fact Arjuna, did he say anything about Krishna or who Krishna was?
He said that Krishna was Babaji. He said that he himself was Arjuna. He said to me, that's why I'm so close to Babaji in this life. This whole question of reincarnation is endlessly fascinating and a real trap. Okay. You know, all right, one more.
Thank you, Swamiji. I just wanted to ask you, what do you see as for the future for Ananda and its communities?
What do you see for the future of Ananda and its communities?
Ananda communities will cease to be just communities. It will be a worldwide movement. It will be a worldwide spread of consciousness. We are spreading cooperation. I see Ananda as really flowering into thousands of communities like it. And I believe it very strongly. Somebody came to Ananda recently, and he was just amazed to find there was not one unkind person. Right. That's the kind of example the world needs. And I believe that that example will uplift the world. Any questions? I have to say that I'm deeply disappointed in you. None of you has asked me the one central question of the medieval scholars: how many angels can dance on the head of a pin? Thank you all very much.
Swamiji, I want to ask people to bless you.
Okay.
This is Swamiji's last event in Los Angeles before he returns to L.A., I'm sorry, to Ananda Village. And just out of gratitude for all that he has shared with us, if we could send him our blessings by rubbing our hands together and then chanting Om 3 times.
I feel your blessings and I want to return them. Om, Om, Om. God bless you all.